We're used to hearing about fracking and other natural gas development in rural areas of Pennsylvania, but that's changing.
It is our premise that it is only a matter of time before there are going to be significant encroachments into these high-density populations.
I'm Carol Holzapfel. This week on the Allegheny Front, natural gas drilling comes to the suburbs. And we love chocolate. But before it's made into a bar or bonbons, chocolate, cacao, is a fruit. And its flavors hint at a diversity of plants we might be losing.
My eyes were popping out of my head. I'm not kidding. I was tasting something that tasted a lot like sweet tarts.
Plus, our intrepid reporter braves the cold to get the scoop on a popular winter sport.
What?
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. Over 3 million people get their drinking water from the Ohio River, which gets its start in Pittsburgh. There's a multi-state commission charged with ensuring that water in the Ohio is safe for drinking and other uses. Now that commission is considering whether to eliminate its pollution control standards. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant has more.
Pennsylvania, Ohio, and West Virginia are among the six states that work together toward clean water in the Ohio River through ORSANCO, the Ohio River Valley Water Sanitation Commission.
That's making sure it's safe for drinking water supply, aquatic life, fish consumption, and recreation.
That's ORSANCO Director Richard Harrison. He says the commission looks at its water quality standards every 3 years, but this year is different. This time, ORSANCO is considering whether to eliminate its pollution control standards for sewage and industrial waste altogether. Harrison says those water quality protections are already addressed by the U.S. EPA and ORSANCO's member states.
So the commission is looking through this review holistically to really determine, is that still an effective use of ORSANCO's resources, or is it largely redundant?
ORSANCO has developed five alternatives to the current standards. The one favored by a majority of commissioners would eliminate their standards. A minority of ORSANCO commissioners in opposition finds at least 188 instances where ORSANCO has a regulation for the Ohio River, but the states and the EPA do not. John Stoltz says the ORSANCO oversight is needed. He's director for the Center of Environmental Research and Education at Duquesne University.
Anytime you relieve yourself of your charge, you no longer become a viable entity.
Stoltz says the proposal would eliminate ORSANCO's cooperative mission, which keeps the Ohio River states working together toward a common goal. Plus, he says the current regulatory system is working. The Ohio River is cleaner than it used to be.
It may sound harmless and saying, oh, yeah, well, we can always rely on somebody else to do this. But then you've lost control, and it comes back to then who is really responsible and how are these regulations, more importantly, going to be enforced.
ORSANCO's five proposals, including the favored alternative to eliminate pollution control standards, are open for public comment until February 24th. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
State environmental regulators are issuing a $12.6 million penalty against Sunoco for permit violations related to the construction of its Mariner East 2 pipeline. State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick reports.
The State Department of Environmental Protection halted construction on the pipeline in early January, citing problems that impacted private well water supplies. Because of this penalty, work is now allowed to resume. The pipeline, which spans southern Pennsylvania, is designed to move natural gas liquids from the western part of the state to an export facility near Philadelphia. The natural gas liquids are then destined for use in the European plastics industry. The $12.6 million will go towards environmental funds related to clean water and dams. State regulators say it's one of the biggest civil penalties collected in a single settlement. Marie Cusick, State Impact Pennsylvania.
Before DEP issued that penalty to Sunoco and lifted the order suspending construction on Mariner East 2, Questions were being raised about how the controversial pipeline got approved by the DEP in the first place. The questions stem from documents which surfaced as part of a lawsuit challenging the pipeline's permits. They show text messages exchanged between a senior staffer in Governor Wolf's office and the state's chief environmental regulator. State Impact Pennsylvania published the documents, and their reporter, Susan Phillips, joins me to talk about the story. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Kara.
Well, first, can you describe the Mariner East 2 pipeline project and the circumstances that led up to these texts in question?
Sure. The Mariner East 2 is a large natural gas liquids pipeline that would run 350 miles from Ohio and parts of West Virginia through 17 counties in Pennsylvania. It has a 50-foot right-of-way and crosses more than 1,200 streams and wetlands. It's a major, major project. And the DEP had originally rejected Sunoco's permit applications twice, saying they were incomplete and lacked information. They issued Sunoco a list of deficiencies in the fall of 2016. And deficiencies are areas where the permits either have inaccurate information or don't have the proper information about how the company would prevent polluting the waters of the Commonwealth that they cross or causing earth disturbance. And landowners who opposed the project were critical of the permitting process and thought the project would never be able to be properly permitted to prevent pollution. In the meantime, Sunoco was working on a deadline and they wanted to get the pipeline built. You know, right now they're 18 months behind schedule. At the time, they're sort of rushing to make sure that they got the permit so they could start construction. And these texts that surfaced, they're between the head of the Department of Environmental Protection, Patrick McDonnell, and an aide to Governor Wolf. Her name is Yesenia Bain. And the texts occurred during the weeks leading up to the DEP granting the permit. And, of course, during this time, Sunoco had a long to-do list and a short deadline. Now, much of the texts are actually blacked out. In fact, 6 pages of text. So there's a lot we really don't know.
So what do we know? What can we read? And, you know, what's the character of the text?
Wolf staffer Yesenia Bain asked the head of the Department of Environmental Protection not to send these deficiency letters to Sunoco detailing problems with its permit applications until the governor could be updated. She also asked whether some deficiencies that are cited in Sunoco's Mariner East 2 plans could remain flexible for field adjustments, and not really sure what that means exactly. But in February 2017, soon after these series of texts were transmitted between the two, DEP actually approved Sunoco's permits with conditions. Now, some landowners and environmentalists say that Wolf injected political pressure on the DEP to approve these permits, and they're saying that this is a decision that should be based solely on environmental standards and not politics. They say that those standards and regulations were subverted to help Sunoco make its projected timeline on the project. The text messages also show a Sunoco lobbyist communicating directly with the governor's office over the permits rather than directly with DEP.
Now, this Wolf administration staffer, Bain, has also been accused of having a conflict of interest.
Yes, Bain is married to a gas industry lobbyist, which, of course, raises some red flags. Now, the governor's office says there's no conflict of interest.
No conflict of interest, she has no conflict of interest in her job. But what does the governor's office say about these texts?
Yeah, the governor's office basically says this is normal, that this, you know, communication between the two is normal on such a large project as this, and it's perfectly normal for the governor to be kept informed and that these exchanges are routine. But, of course, the pipeline opponents see it very differently. They say the texts show that the governor's office is exerting undue influence over a process that should be left to environmental regulators. And, you know, Kara, this is something they've suspected all along, that the DEP was getting pressure from the governor's office to approve a project riddled with problems.
Right. In fact, the homeowners along the pipeline route, some of which have had to give over their property through eminent domain, have suggested that the process for pipeline permitting is being fast-tracked.
Right.
Governor Wolf is going to be looking for re-election soon. Is there any political blowback as a result of these kind of things coming out?
You know, it's hard to know. Certainly the folks who are living along this pipeline route in the Philadelphia suburbs are not happy with how the construction has played out. Many of them continue to be critical of the Wolf administration and the Wolf administration's role in, you know, the construction of the Mariner East 2 pipeline project. They're asking Wolf to do a risk assessment of a natural gas liquids pipeline because it's different than just regular natural gas. And they're worried that there could be safety issues even after construction is completed and the pipeline is in the ground. Wolf has said that he supports a risk assessment, but he says that the Public Utility Commission is the one to do it. And the Public Utility Commission has basically punted. I mean, they're not really saying whether they're going to do it or not.
Well, thank you so much, Susan.
My pleasure.
Susan Phillips is a reporter with State Impact Pennsylvania. That's a collaboration among the Allegheny Front and public radio stations WITF, WHYY, and WESA to cover the Commonwealth's energy economy. There's more at AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Kara Holsapple. One person's idea of a good time can be another person's, well, personal challenge. When it comes to sailing down a hill of man-made snow on an inflatable donut, you just never know until you try it.
It seemed steep, kind of, so the first time you were scared, but after that it was pretty fun.
Later on the Allegheny Front, we take you snow tubing, ready or not. Stay tuned. There's a ban on fracking within the city of Pittsburgh. But the gas industry is moving into some of Pittsburgh's biggest suburbs, and it's rekindling a debate about the risks and benefits of drilling. Reporting for State Impact Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier found that suburbanites are now deciding what to do about fracking in their own backyards.
Plum Borough is one of Allegheny County's more expansive suburbs. At 29 square miles, it's bigger than Manhattan. It's a landscape of rolling hills and steep hollows just 7 miles east of the Pittsburgh city line. Michael Thomas, who grew up in the city, discovered that landscape when he came to work in Plum as borough manager 13 years ago.
When I first came here and saw the horses and the cows and the sheep, I mean, just something you don't expect in a Pittsburgh suburb. It just isn't.
Over the years, houses have started to fill in those open spaces. For decades, Plum has had small, conventional gas wells dotting its landscape. Thomas didn't think that the bigger, more intensive operations of the Marcellus shale industry would come to this community of 27,000. Then one day last summer, it did.
Actually, to be honest with you, I was on vacation, and I got an email from a council member that said, "Are you going to the meeting tonight?" And my response was, "What meeting?"
It was a public hearing for an underground injection well for fracking waste, held by the EPA. 200 residents came out to oppose it. Pretty soon, the borough got word that another company wanted to build shale gas wells. This came as a surprise to Thomas, who thought that the drilling industry would stay in the more rural parts of the state.
We were not anticipating a lot of requests or a lot of permit requests for wellheads in Plum because property down here is, all things being equal, properties, you know, you can buy, you can get a lot more property up in Elk County a lot cheaper than you can in Allegheny.
But in the last year or so, interest in gas drilling in Pittsburgh suburbs has increased. Wells have been permitted or are being planned for as close as 4 miles from the city line. Fracking has brought jobs to Pennsylvania and riches for some landowners, but also controversy. Opponents say the process burdens local communities with truck traffic, emissions from gas wells, and the potential to harm groundwater. But that debate has largely skipped over Pittsburgh and its biggest suburbs, until now. Doug Shields is a former city council member from Pittsburgh who now works for the environmental group Food and Water Watch. He says all you need to do is look at a map of gas wells in western Pennsylvania to understand why the gas industry is interested in the suburbs of Pittsburgh.
You'll immediately take note that Allegheny County looks like an island in a sea of gas wells on their maps.
But drilling companies have so far stuck to the surrounding, more rural counties. Allegheny County has just over 100 Marcellus gas wells, while Washington County, to the south, has 1,700.
And it is our premise that it is only a matter of time before there are going to be significant encroachments into these high-density populations.
Allegheny County has 130 municipalities, some as small as 50 acres. Each can regulate fracking through zoning. So deciding where companies can drill is now becoming a big open question in Pittsburgh suburbs. Through his job with Food and Water Watch, Shields offers to help communities update local laws to include gas drilling restrictions. He said only about a third have zoning ordinances that have up-to-date oil and gas designations. But he said that's beginning to change.
And these communities kind of woke up quickly and began to understand they need to protect themselves.
Oakmont, next to Plum, has enacted stricter limits on gas wells. Monroeville also adopted a more restrictive zoning policy, but the municipality is now rethinking that decision. A few months ago, Plum decided to allow drilling in about a third of the municipality. Thomas, the Plum manager, said that was a compromise. Some residents who owned gas rights wanted to expand the map to allow drilling in more densely populated areas. Others wanted to restrict it to just a handful of industrial zones.
My rule is always to try to strike the balance. You know, if we don't let people make money, you know, we don't have a healthy economy here in the community. If you have everything running rampant, you lose residents because nobody wants to be. So it's always about striking that balance.
He said public opinion in the borough was mixed, but that most he'd talked to were friendly to the idea of drilling.
I'd say it's probably about 60-40. I'd say, you know, 6 out of every 10 people that I talk to are, you know, let's drill, let's drill, let's drill. And about 4 of every 10 are, you know, we gotta think about this. We gotta stop this.
On top of that, he worried that the company drilling the well, Huntley and Huntley, would sue the borough if it made the ordinance too restrictive.
Our thought process was essentially that there was a pretty good risk of losing that battle.
Huntley and Huntley did not agree to an interview. But in an email, a company spokesman said that problems predicted by environmentalists at the company's other sites never materialized, and that the company was concentrating its Marcellus drilling on the more sparsely populated parts of Plum. The company's first Marcellus gas well in Plum is now taking shape. Dave Vento takes me to see it.
You know, there's the site. See, that's the Midas well pad.
Vento is a foreman with the Pennsylvania Turnpike and sat on Plum's borough council for 12 years. At the side of a busy road, backhoes move dirt around a construction site.
This was woods. It was all woods. I used to actually ride dirt bikes and through this area. You know, this was a fruit stand here.
It looks like it could be any kind of development, but in a few months, a drilling rig will be erected there. At a nearby Panera, Vento says he doesn't want large-scale fracking to come to Plum. He's worried about truck traffic, potential damage to water wells, and how industrial activity would mix with this bedroom community. He says he understands some of his neighbors would benefit from lucrative royalty payments, but doesn't think it's worth it.
Well, I would say absolutely it's good for them, but at what cost to the rest of the community? You live in a community. You don't live by yourself. You know, this isn't the Wild Wild West. We live in a community. We're surrounded by humans, you know. It's just what you consider your right and what you don't consider your right.
As drilling moves into the suburbs here, it's a question more and more people will be asking. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
On Valentine's Day, I have to admit, it's chocolate that has my heart. So I was more than a little concerned when I read the book Bread, Wine, Chocolate by journalist Simran Sethi. She chose chocolate and other favorites like wine and coffee to tell a story about the loss of biodiversity in all the foods we enjoy. She points to some important numbers, like this one. 95% of the world's calories come from just 30 species. I spoke with Sethi about this and asked why that statistic is a problem.
If you think about it the way we think about something like an investment portfolio, if we're, you know, advised by someone on how to invest what little money we may have in savings, what they all say is don't put everything in one basket. What we know when we do that, if we say put everything in one stock, let's say, and that stock crashed, you would lose everything. So the exact same thing is happening to food, but it's this greatest, you know, most important story about food and agriculture that isn't really being told. You know, our diet has now collapsed globally into really wheat, rice, corn, soybeans, and palm oil. And we're growing the same types of foods and we're growing the same varieties. And they tend to be the ones that are high yielding and that are disease resistant to whatever capacity they can be. But the problem with doing this is if one of them succumbs to a disease, if one of them succumbs to a pest, then what happens? If we haven't been growing diverse varieties of not only those five foods, but all the foods that we love, then we'll lose them.
I love the scene in the book where you're on the cacao farm. And that's the plant that chocolate comes from. I think it's in Ecuador. And you say of that experience, these were the tastes of biodiversity. Could you describe that scene a little bit and what you meant by that?
I've been eating chocolate my entire life. So it's something I love deeply. But I never considered where it came from. And then there I was in the center of origin for cacao. So cacao, as you said, becomes chocolate. And I entered into a forest, a very dense forest, and there are these trees and they have these things hanging off of them that look like kind of ridged footballs. And they're absolutely bizarre because they're very, very heavy. And they're on these kind of tiny stems on thick trunks. And you're like, where am I? Like, what is this weird thing hanging off this tree? And you split it open and there's this pulpy white fruits inside. And inside of those fruits are the seeds that will one day become chocolate. And the tastes of biodiversity are right there. And what I mean by that is that within every single one of those cacao pods, those little fruits that come in colors ranging from purple to green to yellow to red, there are myriad tastes of what the fruit tastes like. And when I dug my hands, my very sticky, dirty, insect-repellent, sticky hands into those fruits, which are kind of very moist, very warm, you know, because I'm in a tropical forest, and I dug out these fruits and I popped them in my mouth. My eyes were popping out of my head. I'm not kidding. I was tasting something that tasted a lot like sweet tarts. I was tasting, you know, something lemony. I was tasting something a little bit more approximating a nut, you know, and it was like, what is happening here? All these flavors are in this one pod of cacao. And then you start to think about this and you're like, wow, once these seeds are roasted and turned into something, they have a special taste. And every single region in the world that grows cacao is known for a particular kind of taste, but it's starts right there.
If I read correctly, you sold your house and really changed your life. You traveled, of course, extensively to report these stories. How did the experience of writing the book change you?
I sold my house, I gave away my car, and I started on this journey across six continents over 5 years. And I didn't realize at the time, but what it did was it showed me that I was never alone. That every mug of coffee that I drink connects me back to Africa. I mean, a continent I had hardly ever thought of, much less Ethiopia, where coffee was born, that continues to sustain the biodiversity we'll need in the future. And I'm humbled by this. And I look at that cup of coffee as in a different way. I'm alone, but I'm never alone. The whole world is connected to me through my plate. I may have bought those apples at a local farmer's market, but the center of origin for apples is China. You know, I may have bought that wheat, you know, at a local bakery, but that wheat was born in the Middle East, you know, a place that's now going through severe political strife, you know, that we wouldn't have chocolate for the grace of, you know, without the grace of places like Peru and Ecuador. Like, what? I hadn't even thought of these places. I am so grateful for this journey. It has forced me to connect with the world, and it has reminded me of my place in the order of things. That's the biggest awareness that's come from me. I had been so disconnected from my food, and I had been so disconnected from myself. And then here I was, finally, returning to myself, returning to that just sweet, sacred 2 minutes with that cup of coffee, you know, just putting that spoon of food in my mouth and really tasting it. And to me, it's changed who I am, and it's changed the way I see the world. I write in the book, this is a book about food, but it's really a book about love, and I mean it.
Simran Sethi is the author of Bread, Wine, Chocolate, The Slow Loss of Foods We Love. If you enjoy chocolate as much as I do, or almost as much as I do, check out our website. There's an excerpt from the chocolate chapter there. That's at AlleghenyFront.org. Are you excited about the Winter Olympics in South Korea? Well, as far as I know, snow tubing is not an Olympic sport yet. But a couple of years back, the Allegheny Front's Jennifer Shveta Jordan approached Allegheny County's Boyce Park with the mindset of an athlete and the curiosity of a journalist. As kids of all ages whizzed down the slopes on their round, rubbery snow tubes, she used her headphones as earmuffs and trekked up a hill of man-made snow to bring us this audio postcard.
Yeah. I'm a reporter, that's why I'm so goofy.
Getting on and off the conveyor belt that takes you up the hill can be the most worrisome part of this adventure. I slipped the first time.
It's our first time here, actually. We came one time before, and it was so crowded we couldn't get a pass.
You're about to get involved in a snowball fight here. Stay here too.
That always seems to be the case.
All right, buddy, come on, let's go.
Could you guys explain what you're doing here?
Just sit like this, and then put your feet out, and just go this way, and then slide down.
Right?
Yep.
Hang on tight.
Mm-hmm.
Did you say you've been here before?
I used to ski here when I was about her age, I guess, yeah.
Okay.
But I haven't been here in years, and now I'm back to two. It's pretty fun.
Do you know how high this is?
I really probably couldn't tell you about that. I did ask the guy how fast it was. I thought maybe around 30 miles an hour. And he said somebody did it with an iPhone. And he said they were going 27.
Now, was she not scared at all? Because I just went down, and actually, maybe it was because, you know, I was alone. But, like, I was surprised at how much I was going backward.
Yeah,
and,
me too.
First,
I flipped backwards.
And I was just like, yeah, I don't like speeding places and not knowing
not
where I'm going. But I'm like, okay, it can't be that dangerous, right?
Yeah.
So
she's not scared at all.
Yeah.
She's a little daredevil.
It seemed steep, kind of, so the first time we were scared, but after that it was pretty fun.
Okay, I'm ready to be pushed.
You want me to push you?
Oh, okay. Thanks, yeah. What? For the Allegheny Front, I'm Jennifer Shveta Jordan.
Those were the voices of Joe Braun and his son Max, Ben Sopkak with his niece Jillian Dell, and Swapnil Desai. Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show and our podcast, Trump on Earth. All of those episodes, and we're up to 34 now, are at trumponearth.org. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Katherine Mabus McKenna Foundation, and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation.